listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Swan, and this week I interview Stuart M. Harris. He began writing for the theater professionally in 1991 when he was invited by the Ensemble Studio Theater in New York to attend a summer conference. The experience led him, the native Californian, to move to New York and become a playwright. Several of his plays have been produced off-Broadway and around the country. Among them, On a Field, produced by a diverse theater company, and Colleen Ireland, about a 90-year-old retirement home resident and her great-granddaughter, which played in New York, Spokane, and other cities, including Hamilton, Ohio, where it won Best Play at the Fitton Center One-Act Playwriting Contest. A follow-up to Colleen was Spindrift Way, the first of 10 more plays in the series. The Northeast Quarter began as a full-length play developed by the Works in Progress Theater Lab in the Manhattan Theater Club Studios. Harris put playwriting on hold in order to weave the story of generations of Iowan farmers into his new historical novel. He currently lives in Brooklyn. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and thanks for listening. All right, I'm here with Stuart. Stuart is a recent novelist, wrote a book called The Northeast Quarter, and we're just going to talk a lot today about that novel, and then I would love to get into details about your writing in general. Thank you so much for being here, Stuart.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I love your career path. I'm so intrigued because, as I understand it, you went from graduating Stanford,
yes,
into property management, and then,
yes,
into being a playwright, and now trying out being a novelist. So talk a little bit about how all these things happened.
Well, I'd always, I guess, wanted to write.
Mm-hmm.
I got into others, let's say, got into other things. I mean, there's this trajectory we're looking at. There's a few doors. I tried doors, and they weren't the right ones. And I finally fell into writing by accident. I can get into that in a second. But mm-hmm. I was a travel agent for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I'd write the damn tickets, and I'd see where these people were going, and hell, I wanted to go too. I didn't want to be sitting in my desk in L.A. So then I moved on. I worked in an art gallery,
mm-hmm,
and it was L.A. Institute of Contemporary Art, and I was answering the phones,
mm-hmm,
and the same thing happened. They'd have the artists, they'd have their paintings on the wall in the back, and, you know, they'd have these showings, and people would come with the wine, you know, and the cheese and all this stuff, and here I was out by the phone. I wanted to have something on the wall, too. So I always felt like there's got to be something here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened, how I got into this, is I then was in doing some property management, which I stayed in. But in 1985, I was at a supermarket, and I saw this bulletin on the bulletin board saying Bunko Theater was the name of it. And what this was, it was a group of senior citizens that had a van. And they were all retired actors.
Mm-hmm.
And they went around to senior centers performing skits on how to alert other seniors to crimes and whatever, swindles, scams, mm-hmm, perpetrated against the elderly. Well, they were looking for some younger people, because I was at that time just almost 40. They were looking for someone to help, like, load the van,
mm-hmm,
you know, or in other words, help out. So I figured, okay, heck, I'll volunteer. So I did, and it essentially was helping them unload and load the van and go to another, you know, senior center and whatever. Well, about 2 months into it, one of the actors was an older guy, looked at me, and he said, "Harris, you got an honest face." And I thought, well, okay. He says, "How would you like to play the perp in our skits?" So I said, sure. And, well, Swan, this was great fun because I was a Bible salesman in one scene. I was a flasher in the park in another scene. It was like little 10-minute skits. And I'd always get led off by an older fella playing a cop at the end, but it got me on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was enjoying this, you know. Well, these skits were written by a film student at UCLA. And he then graduated and went on, and they were left without a writer.
Okay.
So I said, okay, I'll volunteer. Why don't I write some of the material? So I began, but then I realized I need material. So I thought, where the heck can you get material? You go to the police station. So my wording was wrong here. I went down to the Santa Monica police station. Went up to the sergeant. I said, I'd like to talk to somebody who can show me how to swindle some old people.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that was the wrong word to you. That did well. Yeah, I got a raised eyebrow, and I said, no, I'm a writer. I'm looking for material. Well, anyway, he introduced me to one of their detectives in the back, and this guy provided me with material.
Mm-hmm.
This went on about six more months, but this is now we're into 1986. And this was during Reagan's second term, and they were closing down a lot of government offices. Well, this little bunco theater was an offshoot of an office in Santa Monica. Well, it was technically a kind of, say, like a frill. Mm-hmm. And it got closed down. Well, it left me hooked on writing plays, but I didn't know how. So I went to UCLA at night, night school, and took as many playwriting courses as I could. Well, in 1991, I sent my class project to Ensemble Studio Theater back here in New York, and they invited me to their summer conference that year, and that got me back to New York.
Okay.
Learning how to write, or learning to be a playwright. So it was, I kind of fell into it.
Yeah, I love, looking back, you can see all the things that seemed to just happen, but also led you to where you are. Let's talk a little bit about the novel.
Yes.
A brief summary. We're following a character, Anne, as she ages from 10 to adulthood, and following her family as, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but just following her family as a series of very unfortunate events continue to happen to her and her family.
Yeah.
And then finding, I guess, resolution, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is there more you want to add to the summary?
Well, actually, what it is, it's the difficulty of keeping a, say, promise and being true to yourself.
Yes.
And so I can kind of phrase this as a resume of the plot. I'll kind of give the pitch that I've given to old bookstore owners and whatever.
Yeah, give us the pitch.
Okay. Picture a kingdom somewhere. And the king is at a banquet. And he's looking down the table at this banquet to all of the nobles, but he's an older man. He looks down the table to the princess, who's his granddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "I want you to promise me that when you are of my standing here, it's your turn giving this speech, which is on a holiday, which would be the 4th of July, that you will preserve the Northeast Quarter, which is the most valuable land, piece of property in the entire kingdom. And I want you to promise me that you will do that." Well, the princess says, "Okay, Grandma." "No, young lady, you promise me that you will do it." She says, "Okay, I promise." And he says, no, you promise as if your life and soul depended on it. You promise me. Okay, I promise, Grandpa, I promise. Well, she's made the promise, and a few seconds or maybe half hour later, a disgruntled neighbor comes in and kills the king. Mm-hmm. Now, the princess is left with this promise. The trouble is, and this is what Anne's problem is, the trouble is the princess is only 10 years old.
Yeah, being and a what, child and a woman.
What the heck is she going to do? Right. Well, at 10 years old, all she can do is watch as every crook and conniver comes out of the woodwork to carve out a piece of the estate. Mm-hmm. And she has to match wits with everyone who comes across her path till she's old enough to fight back.
Yes.
That's the book, essentially.
That sums it up pretty well. Switch the setting to Iowa, and we've got it.
Yeah, move it to Iowa between 1918 and 1930, mm-hmm. which would be the end of World War I and heading right into the Great Depression.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit about some of the themes. You mentioned them in your pitch, but one thing is corruption. It seems that many times in the book, overwhelming odds, good against evil, and evil being, I don't know, set up to be successful. Talk about that conflict and how that developed as you're writing.
Well, okay, this is the time as well when in the rural areas, the Great Depression began to creep in.
Yes.
And when I was thinking of this, this was a time period that was similar to what we were going through at the time I began writing the book. In other words, there were banks that were doing what we call now predatory lending.
Mm-hmm.
The farmers essentially were providing food and whatever. This is back in the time the book is set.
Mm-hmm.
Food, whatever. The banks' interest rates were low, and they were making money. They were selling the crops, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, now along comes this boom after World War I and the stock market. And then bankers suddenly decided, hell, we can start raising the rent, or not the rent, but the interest on mortgages. And in other words, they got corrupt. Because there were, like, stock market, it meant money, money, money.
Right.
And so what happened, of course, is that in the cities, they were, hell, it was prohibition.
Right.
And so corruption set in, and it's easy, you could say, in this book, if you get one really corrupt guy to assume a position of power, he can corrupt the whole financial system in the entire county. And he happens to be the one that takes over this empire.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Royce Chamberlain. And Anne has to match wits with him the whole book until she can go after him at the end.
Yes. And that's scary and satisfying at the same time.
Yeah.
And it definitely rang true as the experience of, you know, people in the more rural areas.
Yeah.
Coming up to the Depression and then during. But also, yeah, it's a great thing. It carries over the emotion and the structure of what happened recently in the economy. So, and then I found myself getting a little mad at you.
Me?
In the book, because about Anne, there's something else that happens that's terrible, and something else that happens that's terrible, and something else, and you're just, how much can one person be subjected to in one life? How did you feel as you were writing all these things? I mean, just pushing her further and further into this corner, and then trying to break out of that, you know, once she's an adult.
Well, okay, what I wanted to show is this was before feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to show, you know, you're right about me setting up the opposition against her.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to show somebody, a woman, who was tough as nails, who could stand up. Okay, if she couldn't fight them, she'd outwit them.
Yes.
And she's constantly, if like somebody asked her, what do you think of, say, women's rights? She would be too busy to answer because she's fighting a battle. She's like a soldier crossing a like battlefield in a pitched battle right then.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone were to say to her at the end, are you a, say, feminist icon? She might think a minute and say, well, I guess so. I suppose. She's, in other words, she's too busy. She is a feminist icon because she takes this crap, and at the end, she's the last one standing.
Yes.
But she has to grow up. And her problem is that during the time she's growing up, she can't fight back. All she can do is like, again,